I'd like to start off by welcoming everyone to our class, Parsha of the Week, Achrei Mos Kedoshim, 5767. We're looking for conversations with Hashem. In Leviticus, there's not as much storyline, so it's a little fewer and farther between. And the conversation that I would like to listen in on with you today is implicit, not explicit. And it is found hidden in the context of the first several verses of Achrei Mos. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Achrei Mos Shnei Bnei Aharon Bekor Vasom Lifnei Hashem Vayamusu. Hashem spoke to Moshe after the death of the two sons of Aharon when they approached before Hashem and they died. This incident, which is mentioned, the two sons of Aharon approaching before Hashem and subsequently dying, was indeed reported in the Torah back in Parsha Shemini, chapter 10. And the details surrounding that story are given there. There are various interpretations of exactly what occurred, but the fact that we all agree on is that it occurred on the first day of the month of Nisan, which was the day of the inauguration of the Mishkan of the Tabernacle. Two sons of Aharon were great men. Moshe remarks after their death that they were the greatest of the men in their generation, even greater than perhaps Moshe and Aharon themselves. And the reason for their death was that they did something which, for people on their level, was considered to be a severe misdeed. It had to do with something having to do with service, temple service. The Midrash has several different interpretations of what it was that they did. Some of the most well-known are that they entered into the sanctuary after they had drunk wine, and so they were in a state of intoxication. Some say that they brought an incense offering, which was not authorized by Moshe. Some say that they entered into the Holy of Holies, which was also not an authorized entry. Whatever the case may be, they were men of great height, and one of the reasons why Hashem took their lives was to establish from the beginning that the Mishkan, the Tabernacle, is a very, very holy place, and you're dealing with high voltage, so to speak, and any wrong step or any action which is taken which is not in accordance with the laws of the sacrifices can be fatal. And the Jewish people discovered on that day how Hashem was truly in their midst, literally, not just figuratively, that there was so much intensity of the divine presence that indeed it was like playing with fire. And that was, in a certain sense, Hashem calls it a Kiddush Hashem. God was actually sanctified when the people realized just how much in their presence he was. Unfortunately, it happened at the cost of these two great righteous tzaddikim. So that is really the story, and that's in Shemini. In this parsha, Hashem prepares to instruct Moshe and Aharon concerning the laws of Yom Kippur, which is very lengthy, and it is the first half of the first parsha Achrei Mos, describing in detail the Yom Kippur service. Anybody who has attended the Yom Kippur davening knows that there's a whole litany of verses describing all of the sacrifices that were offered on Yom Kippur. We know that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, entered into the Holy of Holies only that one day of the year. And that is what is being taught here. As a preface to those laws, the Torah says Hashem spoke to Moshe after the death of the sons of Aharon. Why did it say that? Why did it say Hashem spoke to Moshe after the death of the sons of Aharon? Why didn't it just say Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, here are the laws of Yom Kippur? It is not like the Torah to tell us Hashem spoke to Moshe on a particular day or in a particular event. Just this is what he said. So it's unusual that it says over here Hashem spoke to Moshe after the death of the sons of Aharon. It's definitely unusual. And furthermore, it says, Vayedaber, Hashem spoke to Moshe. And then the next verse says, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. Hashem said to Moshe, speak to Aharon. There seems to be almost an extra verb, and he spoke. It doesn't say he spoke to Moshe after the death of the sons of Aharon, saying. It says, he spoke, and he said. An extra verb. So there's something fishy about this pasuk. So Rashi clears it up, a well-known interpretation. Rashi says that we don't really know what Hashem spoke in the first verse It doesn't say. So he explains it by quoting the Midrash in the name of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, one of the great Mishnah sages. This can be explained by a parable. There was a man who was ill, and he was visited by two physicians. And each physician had medical advice. And they actually, surprisingly, agreed on the diagnosis. One doctor said, "Your condition requires that you stay away from cold. Therefore, do not eat cold food or drink, and do not sleep in a cold, damp climate. This way you will be protected from the cold inside and the cold outside." That's what the first doctor said. The second doctor said exactly the same diagnosis, the same prescription. Do not eat or drink cold, and do not sleep in the cold. But the second doctor added one more thing. "And you should know that I know of another patient who had the same condition as you, and he did not heed this advice, and he did drink cold, and he did sleep in the cold, and unfortunately, that man is no longer with us." And Rashi says, of the two doctors, which doctor has performed his medical duties better? The first one or the second one? The second one, because the second one has made it clear to the patient just how urgent it is for him to heed the doctor's instructions. Well, that is why Hashem said to Moshe, "Acharei Mos Shnei B'nei Aharon." Hashem was about to tell Moshe and Aaron the laws of Yom Kippur. The laws of Yom Kippur imply that only on this day may the Kohen Gadol enter into the Holy of Holies, and only at such and such a time, wearing such and such garments, and with such and such preparation. Implying that if you don't follow these instructions, if you go in the wrong time, or with the wrong material, or with the wrong preparation, you are going to end up like Nadav and Avihu, the two sons of Aaron, who approached the sanctuary without the proper conditions, and they died. So, specifically when it comes to teaching these laws, Hashem wanted to tell Moshe how urgent it is that he follow these instructions to the T. And so, it comes out really, according to Rashi, that there was a separate conversation that went on in the first verse, even before the speaking that went on in the second verse. The second verse is the conversation of the laws of Yom Kippur. The first verse is an introductory conversation where Hashem is saying to Moshe, "I'm about to tell you something, and you have to understand that I'm going to tell you something which is a matter of life and death. So before I tell you what it is, realize that what I'm about to tell you is extremely urgent, and you have to take exceeding care so that the Kohen Gadol, your brother Aaron, and those who would come after him do not perish." And that is the conversation which Hashem shared with Moshe in Pasuk 1. So we have at the very beginning of the Parsha a conversation with Hashem where Hashem tells Moshe that the instructions that are to follow are a matter of life and death. Now, I also like to think that the conversations that Hashem has with Moshe or with Aaron, because we are privy to them in the Torah, especially with the interpretation of our sages, are conversations that we ought to be listening to as well. And when I hear this conversation, quite honestly, I dismiss it right away. And I say, well, this has nothing to do with me, because as we said before, we're not on the level of Nadav and Avihu. It generally doesn't happen. You know, even though people talk this way, maybe it's like a joke, that if a person makes one wrong move and he transgresses God's law, then lightning comes and strikes him dead. People like to say that, but it's almost like a joke, because by and large, that doesn't happen. And we understand that this was a special case. These were holy individuals. They were in the sanctuary. It was the first day. As we said, it was the day that Hashem had to teach the people just how close the presence is. So, what? Am I supposed to think that Hashem is saying, here are the commandments, and if you don't follow every single T, you're going to be struck dead? I don't believe that. And therefore, I don't think that this conversation is really talking to me. But I thought about it a little more, And I said, maybe that tone, maybe that extreme of a statement is not being said to me. But I'll tell you what is being said to me, and is being said to all of us. That one day, God willing, after 120 years, we are all going to meet our Maker. We are all going to reach the day in which we will pass away. The time will come. We're assured of that. I thought of this particularly yesterday, where I attended two funerals and made a shiva call. So one cannot help, when being at such a place, of thinking about the realities of our mortality. And I know I'm not telling anybody anything that they don't know. So what I wanted to do today, because Hashem is conversing with Moshe and with us and saying, whether it's this extreme or whether it's just in general, people, my dear children, one day we are going to move on. And I'd like to just to discuss briefly what is the Jewish response to our mortality.
Rabbi, before you get it, excuse me, let me just interrupt.
Please, now's a good time.
In this English translation, it says, however, this is crucial. Both Yom Kippur and the death of the righteous bring atonement only on one condition. Yom Kippur atones only for people who recognize it as a holy day and treat it as such. Those to whom it is merely a day of refraining from food and work without spiritual dimension do not find atonement on Yom Kippur.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty heavy duty.
I did read that. He actually reminded me to mention it. I forgot to say it. So we'll see about answering your question, but thank you for pointing that out. Maybe we can answer your question later on. But the Midrash gives another interpretation of why the death of Aaron's two sons are mentioned here in conjunction with the Yom Kippur service. And as quoted in the Art Scroll footnote, as Jack just said, it teaches us a lesson that just as Yom Kippur is a day of atonement, where we can be atoned for our transgressions, we talked about atonement last week, and just as Yom Kippur provides atonement, so does the death of righteous people. When a tzaddik passes away, it is atonement for the generation. For the generation. We know also from the sages that whenever a person passes away, a great deal of atonement comes to that individual. Death in itself is an atonement. An atonement is a form of a purification, and we're going to talk about this. In addition to a personal atonement that death accomplishes, so does the death of the righteous accomplish for the entire people. And that is what the reference point is over here. Yom Kippur is an atonement, and the death of the righteous is an atonement. What Jack is referring to is the fact that both of those atonements require some type of acceptance on our part. We have to accept and acknowledge that Yom Kippur is bringing atonement to our souls, and also that the righteous among us are doing so. I'm going to come back to that as we make our remarks about the question of mortality. So I would like to suggest or propose that there are two camps among our people that think about mortality. Call it two different levels, two different orientations, but I believe that everybody thinks about mortality and everybody has a certain fear of dying. But I would like to suggest that there are two different reasons why people have fear of dying. And I would love your comments when I'm finished. Some people are afraid of dying because they don't know what's going to come after. Let me say that a little bit more realistically. They're not sure if anything comes after. All they know is what they know. They know that life is what it is, with all of its hardships, with all of its joys. We are in the company of loved ones. We know our routine. We can function. We're free to move around as we like. We are afraid of that coming to an end. In fact, we are also afraid of becoming sick and infirm and not being able to do all the things that we enjoy doing. And that's a real concern, that's a real fear, and particularly just the thought and the fear that it's all over at the end. This is an individual who, with absolutely no blame whatsoever, is slightly apprehensive about the concept of the world to come, They may have heard of it. They may have heard of it many times. They may have even spoken about it, but they're not really sure what it is. And so it remains, for the most part, the vast and the dark unknown. To such an individual, it is helpful to speak about Olam Haba, to speak about the world to come, to speak about life after death, to speak about the eternity of the soul, and to allow that individual to become more comfortable with the fact that this is not the end, that this is a stage that after we pass away from this life, we move into another phase, and that phase is not necessarily worse than this phase. It is actually very peaceful. It is actually something where we become aware of many things that we're not aware of now. And it's not really something to fear. Sure, we don't exactly know what it's like. Actually, some people may have had experiences where they had a glimpse of what it was like. But the point of the matter is, a person who understands and becomes more comfortable with the idea of life after death is able to assuage some of the anxieties and some of the fears and worries that accompanies us in life. And certainly there's much that has been written about it, and it is a good idea to spend some time, if you do fear immortality, and I'm not saying you shouldn't, it's a good idea to study and to become more comfortable and more aware of the Jewish view on afterlife. There is another group of our people that is also afraid of dying, but not because they lack the awareness of the afterlife. In fact, they're very aware of the afterlife. They're so aware of the afterlife. No, it's not what you're thinking. They're not even afraid what's going to happen to them in the afterlife. Let me illustrate this camp of people by the likes of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon, who, as we know, was the greatest Talmudic sage and righteous person of the last several hundred years. He passed away in the late 1700s, and his level of knowledge, both in the revealed Torah and in the hidden Torah, the mystics, was on par with people hundreds of years before him. The Vilna Gaon was on his deathbed, and he was very, very sad. And he was crying. This is how the story goes. And one of his close disciples said, "Rebbe, why are you afraid? Why are you sad? You know that you have a great future ahead of you in the afterlife." The Vilna Gaon said, "I'm not crying because I'm afraid of what will be in the afterlife. I'm crying because today, as I'm still living and breathing, I can take a few kopecks from my pocket and I can buy a pair of tzitzis, or I could give a few pennies to tzedakah and I can do a mitzvah and I can raise myself and I can draw myself closer to Hashem, which is why I was created. After I leave this world, I won't be able to do that anymore. That's why I cry. That's why I cry. Because after we leave this world, you can't do any more mitzvahs. I'm not even going to say that you can't be elevated, because you can be elevated. We always talk about the Elohi Neshama, about the elevation of the soul. But it's not something that we can do anymore. The elevation comes from the deeds of others whom we may have influenced. Some of the dividends from some of the mitzvahs that we did continue to accrue. And those are the kinds of things that elevate the soul. People's prayers on our behalf, etc. But as far as being able to just put some more data into the computer, we can't do that anymore.
Did he think he meant in a tangible way?
No. The soul, after it leaves the world, cannot do any more deeds. It can experience, but it cannot initiate. It cannot do a mitzvah. In other words, the free will, which is characteristic of this life, is removed. In fact, we become so aware of the divine, so aware of the spiritual world, that really the conditions necessary for free will are no longer available. What have we learned from Rabbi Luzzatto time and again? What makes for free will is the fact that the truth is hidden. The fact that we have options before us, either good or bad. Yes, God, no God, truth, falsehood, it's all around in this world. And therefore, that gives the possibility of choice. If the body is detached and the soul goes up, the soul is completely pristine. The soul goes up to the divine arenas and only sees good, and only sees truth, and only sees right and wrong. There could be no choice. Therefore, there's no such thing as a mitzvah. What is a mitzvah? A mitzvah is an individual who has a choice, making a decision to do the godly thing, to do the right thing, and to do the thing which stands for truth. That's no longer available because it's a whole world of truth. And the Vilna Gaon, on one hand, must have been longing to see what he had been yearning and working for his whole life. On the other hand, that opportunity of choice, of action, is removed from him. That was something that gave him reason to be apprehensive. I'd like to share with you a passage from the Talmud, which I think sheds a little light on this conversation about the two approaches, the two thoughts of mortality and of the afterlife. The Talmud says in Masechet Brachos, Daf Hey, page 5, that a person should spend his life battling between the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara, between the inclination for good and the inclination for bad. And the ideal scenario would be that a person, just by sheer force of will choose the good over the bad. They should struggle, they should fight, they should wrestle, but the good should win over. That's great. If that's not possible, because a person doesn't always have the clarity to do that, what should a person do so that he can prevail? He should study the Torah. He should look into the Torah to help him decide what's good over what's bad. Yasok b'Torah. He should study the Torah. Because if he doesn't have the clarity on his own, he will certainly find it in the Torah. If that's not possible, if maybe he couldn't study, or maybe he looked and he didn't find the answer, or something else, or he tried it and it didn't work, he should read the Shema. He should say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. God is one. Because that kind of covers everything. We may not know how to address the specific issue. I can't study the Torah. I don't know how to deal one way in the business deal, whether he's right, whether I'm right. What will give me the strength, the fortitude to do what is right? If all else fails, say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, and that will help him somehow come to the truth. What if that's not possible? Or what if that didn't work for him? Says the Talmud, then we pull out all stops and we do the last resort, the safety net. What's the safety net? Yizkor Yom Hamisa. Remember that one day we're going to die. And if we remember that one day we're going to die, that will somehow focus us in the right direction, and we should be able to do what's right. It reminds me of a story that I heard once about two religious men that got into a fierce dispute over a piece of land. They were neighbors, and maybe there was questions about the boundary. They went to see one of the great rabbis of the time. I don't remember which one it was. One of the Talmudic sages of the last several hundred years. Maybe it was Rabbi Akiva Eiger. And the rabbi listened to each of them, and each one was arguing vehemently his side and blaming the other guy. Reuven says, it's my land. Shimon says, it's my land. And the rabbi rubs his beard and says, I hear what Reuven's saying, and I hear what Shimon is saying. I can't decide. Let's go and ask the land, the ground, what it says. See, he follows the incredulous men outside, and he goes over into the field that they're disputing, and he bends down, he puts his ear to the ground. And the men think that the rabbi's gone, you know, a little batty. And so they say with a chuckle, Rabbi, what did the ground say? He says, the ground was laughing. And the ground said, Reuven thinks that I'm his, and Shimon thinks that I'm his, but the truth is, eventually both Reuven and Shimon will be mine. And the rabbi was saying to the men, says, you know, we need to calm down a little bit. Everybody is so wrapped up in their desire for possession. We have to remember that one day we're going to leave this world, and hopefully with that thought, they would be able to settle the dispute. Now, the question that is asked, Rav Moshe Feinstein asks it and writes about this, is an obvious question, that if it works, we have the four different ways to prevail over the Yetzer Hara, if we have just the sheer force of will, choosing good over bad, we have studying of the Torah, we have saying the Shema, and we have remembering the day of death, and remembering the day of death always works, why don't we just go straight to that solution when we have a problem? Why doesn't the Gemara say that a person should walk around and remember the day of death so that he will always choose good over bad? Good question. Why not go straight to that if that works? It's more effective than the other ones. So why even bother with the other ones? Let's just walk around all day and say, we're going to die, and then we'll do the right thing always.
Dwell on it, I guess.
Oh. It's like medication, like pain medicine. If the person will feel better with Tylenol, you're not going to give him codeine or morphine because there's side effects. And actually, what happens is that, I don't know how medications work, but let's go straight to the subject at hand. There's two ways to do right. There's two ways to find truth and to find good. One is to negate or nullify ourselves and our bodies. As we said, when a person passes away, the soul goes into a world of truth and is elated. That's one way of having atonement. As we mentioned, death is an atonement. But in order to get the atonement provided by death, you have to stop living. You have to separate between the body and the soul. That's a pretty high price to pay. That basically means there's no more action, no more service, no more choices. There's another way to have atonement. There's another way to be purified. There's another way to be elated by living in a world of truth. And that can be done right here. And that can be done with our bodies, with our minds, with our individuality, with our power of choice. And that is by getting in touch with the truth here right on earth, either on our own, more likely by studying the Torah, and finding truth, and being able to make the right decisions. If those individuals had been clear on what the Jewish law said about their situation, they probably wouldn't have had to argue, and wouldn't have had to be quieted by the stark realization of their mortality that the rabbi had to do. If they had had the presence of mind, they would have come to the rabbi and they said, what does the Shulchan Aruch say? We want to follow the Jewish law. We don't want to dispute. There's got to be an answer. Tell us, rabbi, what's the answer? They skipped over that step. They were still fighting. The evil inclination was burning and they couldn't settle it without being shocked into the fact of their mortality. But the Talmud is telling us we don't want to have to resort to that tactic. We don't have to negate ourselves in order to find truth. We don't have to nullify our bodies or our own choice. We want to be able to find the truth on our own and to find it in a productive way and in a way which we can be fully active and fully participate. That is the highest choice. That is what life is. Life is being able to use our faculties and our bodies and engage and be fully participant in life and doing so in a way where we do it in the right way and in a truthful way. And that's available to us with the Torah. Sure, we could be atoned by negating ourselves, ultimately by death, but there's a much better way. So that is what gives someone like the Vilna Gaon a fear. Because as long as the Vilna Gaon is alive, he's not thinking about death. He is not sitting and wallowing, what's going to be with me? That's not his preoccupation. His preoccupation is, what can I do here? What can I accomplish with my mind while I have it with my body? I can study, I can learn, I can associate with tzaddikim, and I can have access to that wonderful beacon of truth, the light of the Torah. That is a preoccupation of someone like that. That should be our answer in the question of our mortality. Again, let's come back. We may be struggling with the question of life after death, and we cannot discount that. And for that, we must find the sources to strengthen our emunah, our belief, our comfortableness with what happens after we leave this world. Of course, we also need to, as we oftentimes in this class, we speak about the vicissitudes of life and finding meaning even in life's challenges and in illness, chas v'shalom. And that's also important to develop and to strengthen. But we also have to spend the time and the energy in speaking and not shying away from and not being afraid to broach the subject and just living in that unknown sense of what's going to be. Let's find out. Let's calm ourselves with the knowledge and the understanding of the rich Jewish heritage and where we are headed. Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelak le'olam haba. All of Israel has a share in the world to come. We should be aware of that and find ways, both intellectually as well as emotionally, to connect with that idea. But let's remember that if we are on some type of a plateau in that area, we have to remember what makes the Vilna Gaon afraid of his mortality. And we should also realize that life is a blessing, and it is a blessing that should be used. And let us preoccupy ourselves using the opportunities that we have to find truth as we live with vitality. And let us be afraid of the day that we won't be able to study and to do mitzvahs and to give tzedakah. Let that be our fear, and thereby take all the opportunities that we can. All of these thoughts and others perhaps are part of the intention of Hashem saying to Moshe and by his agency to us, Acharei Mos Shnei Bnei Aharon. Let's remember that life is precious. Let's remember that we're all here by the grace of Hashem, and the more that we show Hashem how we are using the gift and how we cherish it and how we can accomplish great things through our life, the more He ought to grant it to us. Mirtz Hashem.
Yes, sir.
I was seeing a sick patient at every this week, and I was coming in, my energy level was low, and I walked into this guy's room, and he had bone marrow cancer. His bone marrow transplant failed, so he had a death sentence. And I walked out of there uplifted for myself.
Mm-hmm.
How can I feel tired, fatigued for myself when this man's going to die? I mean, it was very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really hit me. So when you said, remember that one day we would die, I got that message immediately because I was confronted this man's going to die shortly.
Rabbi Rosenbaum says many times, one of the commentators explains, that the reason why it's a big mitzvah to be mevaker cholim, to visit the sick, is because it gives a person a renewed appreciation for the gift of life and strengthens him or her to continue with vitality. Yeah.
I would like you to go back to the original. I think you started with the story about the patient going to the two physicians.
Mm-hmm.
And you gave us two choices, and I didn't hear you give an answer, but I assumed that it was the second doctor who told him.
Yeah, the second doctor.
Okay, so that is an extreme. In some of these other stories, you were telling us that instead of going to the extreme, instead of having to have the earth tell us that we're going to belong to them rather than they belong to us, it seems to me that that's skipping to the very end rather than giving the person a chance.
Good question.
I don't understand that.
And
right.
Most of my patients would be too scared by the second one and wouldn't do anything. Would be more motivated by the first one.
I'm going to go back to the first doctor.
I mean, they
right.
would hear that message. I mean,
right.
when you're confronted
right.
by death,
right.
people do not want to be confronted by death.
Right.
They
right.
will withdraw. Well, absolutely.
So anyway, the point is, though, I don't get the connection there. It seems like it's the opposite.
Let me restate the question. If the Gemara says that we only resort to the thought of death as a last resort. According to Rashi's parable, why is the second doctor commended for saying in his diagnosis, you're going to die? What I'd like to say is that it's not good to be in denial. Even according to the Talmud and Brachos, it is not good to be in denial. But what the Gemara is talking about is what should be your pep talk? What should be your motivation? I think that Hashem had to tell Moshe, you have to understand the reality. The reality is, if you don't behave properly in the Mishkan, you're going to die. You have to know that. Now, we said it once. Now, as we go on through the Torah and living with the Torah, we are going to accentuate the opportunity for living and how much you can accomplish with your time. And we're not going to harp on death, because that's just going to make the person weaker and accomplish less and give in more to the point of, I don't have any choice and I can't accomplish anything. When he understands it intellectually, he knows that this is the reality. But what motivates him throughout his day is the thoughts of vitality. So the first doctor isn't doing a good job either, because he is allowing the patient to live in a,
dream world.
In a dream world. Yeah, he's allowing the patient to deny, and that's no good for anybody. So the second doctor is better. But day to day, we shouldn't be dwelling on that. I remember reading that Rav Hirsch says, how come it is that the Kohanim are not allowed to be near dead people, except for close relatives? And even to today, because Rav Hirsch, who explains throughout one of the themes, is that the Kohanim are not just Korban technicians. Actually, each one only works 2 weeks out of the year. Kohanim are full-time spiritual people, like teachers, rabbis, and so forth. And he says, those people shouldn't be around death, because thoughts of mortality make a person less active, less productive, take away their vitality, and a Kohen particularly shouldn't be thinking about that too much. So, does that answer the question?
Come back next.
That was a pretty non-committal.
No, that wasn't non-committal. That was committal.
But it just seemed to me that it's out of place. I don't see a connection.
The first doctor is not being straight. He's not telling the whole story. The second doctor is telling the whole story. And you got to know the story. You got to know. Everybody has to know that we're going to die.
I understand it for the Kohanim, and particularly for Moshe.
Well, don't forget, I was adapting this conversation with the doctor to our situation. I was saying that we're not on the level of Nadav and Avihu or Moshe, where you say, you make one wrong room and you're going to die.
Right.
So I said, let me just take that story and let me knock it down a few notches and say that the conversation for us is, people realize that we're here on a mission and life is not endless.
Right.
And everyone has to know that, and no one should be in denial of that fact. Okay, now that we know that, how do we go through life? What do we think about? What do we dwell on? And here we say it's a low level to dwell on mortality all the time.
That's right.
That's the answer.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay?
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. Shkoyach.